This is a poem by Filipino writer Naya Vadillon. It's called The Last Letter to Peter. My heartless boy, don't you remember how you gave me a thimble instead of a kiss? You wanted someone to mother lost boys and thread stories together by the fire, while mending holes in your clothes torn from fighting redskins and pirates alike. I bet that you still get entangled in adventures, that you still wind up frolicking with fairies, teasing tiger lilies, and mooning mermaids on a blue lagoon. You've stranded me here. Is this still another game? Or have you really forgotten my name, which I should have stitched in your memory? For years, I pretend you would fly through the window, take me straight on till morning, give me a kiss, call me darling, and never ask me to grow up. But it's too late now. I have become my mother, compulsively picking up these pins and needles spilled on the floor by wind from the open window. Besides, I have forgotten how to fly. I can never land there where you are, though I have no doubt you have found another. You will always need some other little girl to sew your shadows back on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ella. So next up to our open mic is our current and reigning five words champion, Phyllis Bland.
Thank you. So I'm going to read something from the book that's set in Old Barter 21. Although it means a lot to me, I've met a lot of fascinating, beautiful, long-term friends here, and that's very strange for someone like me, so thank you.
Aww.
I wanted, when I was reading through this poem, I feel like it's me looking back, me being like someone older than myself, looking back at my life and thinking, that was a lovely time. It's by Benjamin Burns, one of my best friends, and I met a lot of best friends here. If you're my friend, if you think you're my friend here, then you're probably my best friend.
Does
that make sense? So, because each moment is so fleeting and individual as a snowflake, and because I was feeling nostalgic for childhood, I decided to recast summer in a new mold by spending Christmas in a holiday home in Baltimore. I practiced my method acting in a local bar where I adopted the role of a drunken sailor, and at the end of a long night on the run, stumbled home in a golf course, passing out on the rough, as battered as an albatross in a snowstorm. I let my thoughts sail away to a bright, happy day, like an Enya lyric or a drunken boat. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, next we have Cedric Bicorne.
So this is a poem from a Quebecer poet, Fabrice Coffey. I will be reading in French and I will try to translate to the best of my ability. Dans sa robe blanche ou noire, elle est la même, elle se laisse voir. Elle t'aspire, elle t'observe. Tu la crains de corps et de sève. Quand elle a faim, tu es son pain. Quand elle a soif, tu es son vin. Elle te laisse rire, croire et rêver. Mais encore renoncer et pleurer. Elle te prend tes amis. Et un jour, généreuse, elle te dit. Jeu du sort. La vie te donne à la mort. her dress, in her black or white dress. She looks all the same, let herself be seen. As she watches and pulls you, you fear she's of flesh and blood. When she hungers, you'll be bread. When she's thirsty, you'll be wine. She lets you laugh, believe, and dream, yet also give in and cry. She takes away your friends, and one day, benevolent, she will say, what an odd fortune. Life gave you away to death.
Merci, Sally. Next, we have Bernadette McCartney.
I'm going to do a bit from the poem Hopkins and Skellig Michael by Paddy Tush. And he actually read here a few months ago, and I couldn't make it that night, sadly. But I actually listened to the MP3 of it, so someone does listen to the MP3s. So anyway, I'll just try and do a short extract. Steps, stone steps, steps cut into stone, step after stone step, steps of stone slabs, slab after worn stone slab, the edge of stone, step, the edges of stone, step, the edges of soul. My soul is stone, a splintered slate, oh let my slow plodding hold me, edge me with brightness. Wow.
Next up, we have Jack Shortland.
I've done this one before. It's Matthew Sweeney died last August, and I just chose this one for a tribute to him. I was going to do another Matthew Sweeney, but I just love this, so it's I'm going for it. And for those who don't know, he's the Donegal man, top of Ireland, came to Cork, and we were blessed with it. So, it's called The Tunnel. When they opened the manhole on the street outside our house, I wanted to climb into it. I could hear the rats calling. I could hear the smugglers manhandling kegs of ale. I could hear the engine of a midget U-boat making inroads from the sea, and behind it whispered German what those bored submariners were saying they'd do. I knew the tunnel went on down the length of Ireland, and I could row for weeks in my homemade dinghy before I'd hit the southern coast, with my strapped-on torch getting weaker, my water and sardines running out. But already I could see the walls lightening, hear gulls at the tunnel's end, then the strange accents of Cork fishermen who stood and watched me emerge.
Thank you, Jack. Next, could we call on Hayley Hughes?
I'm sorry, so yesterday was Seamus Heaney's 80th birthday. So I thought I would read Blackberry Picking. Blackberry Picking, and it's for Philip Hobsbawm. Late August, given heavy rain and sun, for a full week the blackberries would ripen. At first, just one, a glossy purple clot, among others, red, green, hard as a knot. You ate that first one, and its flesh was sweet, like thickened wine. Summer's blood was in it, leaving stains upon the tongue, and lust for picking. Then red ones inked up, and that hunger sent us out with milk cans, pea tins, jam pots, where briars scratched and wet grass bleached our boots. Round hayfields, cornfields, and potato drills, we trekked and picked until the cans were full, until the tinkling bottom had been covered with green ones, and on top, big dark blobs burned like a plate of eyes. Our hands were peppered with thorn pricks, our palms sticky as bluebeards. We hoarded the fresh berries in the byre, but when the bath was filled, we found a fir, a rat-gray fungus, glutting on our cachet. The juice was stinking too. Once off the bush, the fruit fermented. The sweet flesh would turn stout sour. I always felt like crying. It wasn't fair that all the lovely canfuls smelt of rot. Each year I'd hoped they'd keep, knew they would not.
Next up, could we have Elaine Lombard?
This is just my second time here, and I've only written about 1.5 poems so far, and I am just totally, I just think you're all amazing, the intelligence, and the depth you've gone to, and I hope to be quite lucky in years to come. I don't know how long it's going to take. The irony of me being here reading a poem is that when I was going to school, I always thought I was only able to reach a certain level, that I could not go beyond that level, and that I looked at everybody else and I thought, you know, that they are fantastic, but I will only reach this amount. And then in my 40s or 38, there was something really, really just would not leave my mind. And I went back to college by night and I achieved things. And until it was written down in front of me, I didn't believe that I had got this mark or that mark. But going to school also, I had no understanding of poetry. I thought Shakespeare was something completely, I just didn't know. I didn't have the understanding, or I thought it was boring. And now I'm reading Yeats poetry and I love drama. And it's gone all very creative and encroaching and everything, so it's gone very creative. It's been an I think I like Yeats' poem, so I'm going to say a poem by Yeats. Mm. It's called The Ballad of Moll McGee. Come round me, little children there. Now don't throw stones at me, because I mutter as I go, but pity Moll McGee. My man was a poor fisher with shorelines on the say. My job was salting herrings the whole of the long day. And sometimes from the salting sheds I scarce could drag my feet. Upon the blessed moonlight, along the pebbly street. I'd always been but weakly, and my baby was just born. A neighbour minded her by day, I minded her to mourn. I lay upon my baby, ye little children's dear. I looked on my cold baby when the morn grew frosty and clear. A weary woman sleeps so hard. My man grew grey and pale, and gave me money, and bade me to my own hometown Kinsale. He turfed me out and shut the door and gave his curse on me. I went away in silence. No neighbour could I see. The windows and the doors were shut. One star shone and green. The little straws were turning round beyond the bare boreen. I went away in silence beyond old Martin's wire.
I saw a kindly neighbour blowing her morning fire. She took from me my story, my money's all used up. And still with pitying, scorning eyes, she gives me bite and sup. My neighbour said, my man will surely come and take me back again. But always as I'm moving round, without doors or within, piling the wood and piling the turf, I'm going to Glen. I'm thinking of my baby and keening to myself. And sometimes I'm sure he knows when opening up his doors, God lights the stars his candles and looks upon the poor. So now, you dear children, now don't throw stones at me, but gather with your shining eyes and pity Moll McGee.
Okay, very good. Very good. Thank you. That's very kind.
This is Sandy. Sandy's book here from the States. So it will be the poem on her book. Maiden Voyage. I remember this now, a Sunday, as they mostly always were, late fall. I was bending over into the back seat of the car to rearrange the automotive landscape. Her fingers reached over, gently pressing my spine like silver flute keys. I heard the solo even as I felt it fingered for a long time. And by long, I mean still. I wish I had straightened up, turned and kissed her, a new song, a tender response to everything. I felt since and after and before her playing. Or was her hand just warming up, practicing, before it would leave, leaving a stable place to tap out its questions? Send telegraphs into the sky like Jack Phillips and Harold Bride sent for days. The new Marconi operators so busy tapping out jovial wishes from Titanic's first class passengers that the two could barely keep up with the news flooding in of impending ice like the fall before a brutal winter. Except it was spring, as it is now, just weeks away from the anniversary of her sinking. I wish I'd made a move that afternoon, used the binoculars to see the iceberg in time to turn the ship, to turn around and look back to kiss her one first time. But I stay half open in the car, folded like a nautical chart, asleep at the helm, while her hand circumnavigated my back. I kept the memory of that and wrote this poem instead. And Jack Phillips will go down with his ship, and Harold Bride will survive. And I'm not sure which one I am, on which one is she, or which relics of what we are to each other will be recovered years from now from the depths of the sea, placed under glass in an exhibit, never called wreckage, although that's what all this is, and maybe all a maiden voyage is ever meant to be.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you. Next, we have Dee Brown.
Oh. I've never seen it. If my phone doesn't die, I also have a poem by Matthew Sweeney, actually, and it's called Sweeney, and it's his take on the Irish myth of turning into a bird. Sweeney. Even when I said my head was shrinking, he didn't believe me. Change doctors, I told. But why bother? We're all hypochondriacs, and those feathers pushing through my pores were psychosomatic. My wife was the same till I pecked her, trying to kiss her one morning, scratching her feet with my clothes, calling good morning, till she left the bed with a scream. I moved out then onto a branch of the oak behind the house. That way I could see her as she opened the car on her way to work. Being a crow didn't stop me fancying her, especially when she wore that short black number I bought her in Berlin. I don't know if she noticed me. I never saw her look up. I did see boxes of my books going out. The nest was a problem. My wife had cursed me for being useless at DIY, and it was no better now. I wasn't a natural flyer either, so I sat in that tree, soaking, shivering all day. Every time I saw someone carrying a bottle of wine, I called. The takeaway curry was worse. And the day I saw my wife come home with a man, I flew finally into our wall.
He never fails to put a smile on your face. Thanks, Dean. Shona Lynch.
This is a poem by Eileen Sheehan. She read here a few months ago, and I just thought she was brilliant and hilarious. This is called Trending on Twitter. The Blessed Virgin Mary was due to reappear at 8 p.m. above the roadside grotto. It was all over Twitter. The faithful gathered rosary beads at the ready. The skeptics arrived with their iPhones and quotes from sociological studies, having Googled the phenomena of apparitions during the drive-in. The church played it down, played both sides as much as it was able, tried to sound faithful and liberally progressive at the same time. Their spokesman was careful to avoid any questions concerning Magdalene laundries or the Chewin babies, and they couldn't have the Ferns report dug up again. Virginity had always caused them so much bother. More people showed up than was expected. It was a calm evening and the rain held off. The hopeful launched into litanies of rosaries, out loud and in earnest, to help Our Lady along. The others remained quiet, caught up in their own anticipation of nothing happening. At 8:02, someone posted on Facebook, and there she was, or was not, depending on whose comments you read, in her halo of sun, her cloak of cumulus.
Derek Stone is next.
It's a poem by Billy Collins, and it's a good poem to read in this these surroundings. It's called Bar Time. In keeping with universal saloon practice, the clock here is set 15 minutes ahead of all the clocks in the outside world. This makes us rather an advanced group, doing our drinking in the unknown future, immune from the cares of the present, safely harboured a quarter of an hour beyond the woes of the contemporary scene. No wonder such thoughtless pleasure derives from tending the small fire of a cigarette, from observing this glass of whiskey and ice, the cold rust I am sipping, or from having an eye on the street outside when ordinary time slouches past in a top coat, rain running off the brim of his hat, the late edition like a flag in his pocket.
Thank you, Derek. Next up we have Sue Blue.
Thank you very much. I use the occasion to present a translation that I have wanted to do for a long, long time, and I'm going to do the German version first. This is a poem by Kurt Tucholsky, written in 1930. and it's always been one of my favorites. And I'll do the German version first and then my translation. Augen in der Großstadt. Wenn du zur Arbeit gehst am frühen Morgen, wenn du am Bahnhof stehst mit deinen Sorgen, da zeigt die Stadt dir asphaltglatt im Menschentrichter Millionen Gesichter. Zwei fremde Augen, ein kurzer Blick, die braue Pupillen, die Lider. Was war das? Vielleicht dein Lebensglück. Vorbei, verweht, nie wieder. Du gehst dein Leben lang auf tausend Straßen. Du siehst auf deinem Gang, die dich vergaßen. Ein Auge winkt, die Seele klingt. Du hast's gefunden, nur für Sekunden. Zwei fremde Augen, ein kurzer Blick. Die braue Pupillen, die Lider. Was war das? Kein Mensch dreht die Zeit zurück. Vorbei, verweht, nie wieder. Du musst auf deinem Gang durch Städte wandern. Siehst einen Pulsschlag lang den fremden anderen. Er kann ein Feind sein, er kann ein Freund sein. Er kann im Kampfe dein Genosse sein. Er sieht hinüber und zieht vorüber. Zwei fremde Augen, ein kurzer Blick. Die braue Pupillen, die Lider. Was war das? Von der großen Menschheit ein Stück. Vorbei, verweht, nie wieder. Eyes in the city. When you go out to your job in the early morning, when you wait at the train stop with all your worrying, the city shows you concrete smooth in a funnel of humans, millions of faces. Two strange eyes, a short glimpse, the brow, the pupils, the lids. What was that? Maybe your life's bliss, past, blown away, nevermore. Your lifelong you roam on thousands of roads. On your way you see those who forgot about you. An eye winks, the soul rings. You found it for a second split. Two strange eyes, a short glimpse, the brow, the pupils, the lids. What was that? No man turns back time. Past, blown away, nevermore. You must on your journey wander through cities. You see for a pulse beat an unknown someone. They could be a fiend, they could be a friend, they could in the fray be your fellow mate. They're looking over and drifting by. Two strange eyes, a short glimpse, the brow, the pupils, the lids. What was that? Of the grand mankind a slice. Past, blown away, nevermore.
Thank you, Sue. And next up, we have our five-word competition winner, Marianne Smith.
This is a very short poem. It's by a 19th century South American poet called Juan Martín. And it's called I Have a White Rose to Tend, and it's a translation from the original Spanish. I have a white rose to tend in July as in January. I give it to the true friend who offers his frank hand to me. And for the cruel one whose blows break the heart by which I live, thistle nor thorn do I give. For him too, I have a white rose.
Thank you, Marianne. Next we have Benjamin Burroughs.
I'm also going to read a Matthew Sweeney poem.
Okay.
It's called Meh. Before I could speak properly, like many tiny twits, I made up my own words, some of them better than any I've found in all the lingos I've sampled. I mean, take this one. It's a meh. Well, I couldn't have managed the intro words, but I'd shout, meh, and I'd point at it and back away from it at speed to hide under the biggest cushion in the house, where I'd quake like the jellyfish I once saw in the sea, waiting for the meh to float upstairs, stretch itself, and gobble me. I should try to translate the word, but we know how hard translation is. For example, if I say it was a feather, the whole terror aspect is lost. Who fears a feather? But the visual aspect of a meh was indeed a feather. And again, apart from its scariness, it introduced me to the spin of magic and metaphor. How? I don't know. But whenever I saw a meh on the floor, the world would be hopping and suggesting this, that, and the other. Not that I could have articulated such stuff, so maybe it was the first sign that I was meant to become a macar, and I should now make a hat of feathers.
Thanks, Ben. Next we have Jim Quigard.
This one is called The Witches. This is called The Witches, and it's by a poet called Jane Yeh, and she's at the Cork International Poetry Festival last year, and I was just brilliant to her. She's like kind of funny and weird and witty and stuff, so it's called The Witches. The Witches. Their split ends quiver when anyone with bad hair walks by. They ransack dollhouses for miniature beds to put their pets in. They follow a strict diet of beef burgers, rare, and gorgonzola for calcium. They don't want to kill all the birds, just the ones that fit in the size of a doll's bed. Meanwhile, they go soppy over otters and stories about puppies. They can't have dogs because they're always travelling on business. They keep their larders at 15 degrees so the cheese and the birds' heads won't spoil. They use slingshots to stun mice, then train them to nick gold earrings and gemstones. Their oaths and expletives all involve spitting. They understand German because they flew in the war. Their sideline to theft is forging paper for illegal cheeses. When asked, they pose for pictures but with their hands over their faces. They stand with arms akimbo because their pockets are stuffed with mice and prawns. The prawns are to lay a trail for the mice to follow back home. Their houses are made of plasterboard, not cake, and have original sash windows. The gingerbread is a decoy to make them seem less threatening. The duplicitous witches appear to like beef, but they'd rather have lamb. They quibble over millinery and who gets the biggest earrings. They're always falling out and casting hair spells on their rivals. Their antics seem like fun until someone's fringe turns up in a burger. The birds try to trick them by chirping in German. The witches don't believe in vampires because they know that everything dies. They keep bat spheres, not children, stored in spare bedrooms. They think about deep sea diving and the taste of salt and how quiet it is underwater.
Thank you, Jim. We have 7 readers left, and we've just over 10 minutes left, so we have to keep, at least curtail the preamble. That might get us through a bit quicker. We have Niall Herriot next, please.
This is inspired by The Crumbling of Empires. It's by Shelley, and I'm sure you all know it. I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frozen and wrinkled lips and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them, and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear: my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains around this the decay of that colossal wreck. Boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
Thank you, Maya. And next up, all the way from Washington State, Sandy Yaloni.
So this is a poem by the poet Marie Howe, and she wrote this from the collection What the Living Do, in response to her brother's death from AIDS. And I'm just going to acknowledge that today is the anniversary of Titanic sinking, and so I'd like to just read this also for those souls lost. It's called What the Living Do. Johnny, the kitchen sink has been clogged for days. Some utensil probably fell down there, and the Drano won't work but smells dangerous, and the crusty dishes have piled up waiting for the plumber I still haven't called. This is the everyday we spoke of. It's winter again, the sky's a deep, headstrong blue, and the sunlight pours through the open living room windows because the heat's on too high in here and I can't turn it off. For weeks now, driving or dropping a bag of groceries in the street, the bag breaking, I've been thinking, this is what the living do. And yesterday, hurrying along those wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk, spilling my coffee down my shirt and sleeve, I thought it again. And again later, when buying a hairbrush, this is it, parking, slamming the car door shut in the cold, what you called that yearning, what you finally gave up. We want the spring to come and the winter to pass. We want whoever to call or not call, a letter, a kiss. We want more and more and then more of it. But there are moments waiting, walking, when I catch a glimpse of myself in the window glass, say the window of the corner video store, and I'm gripped by a cherishing so deep for my own blowing hair, chapped face, and unbuttoned coat that I'm speechless. I am living. I remember you.
Next up, we have Charles Clark, please.
Greetings again. Out of Ireland have I come. Great hatred is removed, mainly from the start. I carry with me from the moon and as a clock.
Definitely my best friend, Charles. just a few more to go. Just four more to go. Max Greenershank. Woo!
Knowledge.
chance. Just a quick impulse on just five words is all it takes for the balls to emanate. Just one night, it's always great. Anthologies come to those who wait. One, just one tall guy with a beard draws a bunch of poets here. Spinning words, string five words and spit them out of your head.
Thank you, Max. Thank you. Patricia Walsh, please.
It's a piece by John Cooper Clarke. I married a monster from outer space. The Milky Way she walks around, all feet firmly off the ground, two worlds collide. Here comes the future bride. Give me a lift to the lunar base. I want to marry a monster from outer space. I fell in love with an alien being whose skin was jelly, whose teeth were green. She had a big bug eyes and death ray glare, feet red water wings, purple hair. I was over the moon, asked her back to my place, then I married a monster from outer space. The days were numbered, the nights were spent in a rent-free foreign shops intent. When a sidewalk chef turned up to move beans, done super rapid on a laser beam, I needed nutrition to keep up the pace when I married a monster from outer space. We walked out tentacle in hand. You could sense that our things would not understand. They go nudge when you got off the bus, saying it's extraterrestrial, it's not like us. That's bad enough for a human, another race, but fuck me, a monster from outer space. In a cybernetic fit of rage, she pissed off to another age. She lives in 1999 with a new boyfriend, a blob of slime. Each time I see her translucent face, I remember the monster from outer space.
Just two left. Our penultimate reader tonight is Joe Collins.
Okay, I only decided to do this because I think what you're all doing is reciting your favourite poets. So I just think Pat Inglesby has to be a big fan. So I'm going to try and do a little bit. I've tried to write down what I can't remember, and it's all over the place. But anyway, here we go. A present to myself. I've decided to slow myself significantly down this year. No more crazy panicked or hyperactive pressure. I've started by making a very simple calculation. Sorry, people coming up to me asking me, are you busy, or busy are we? And they ask the question with manic high energy and are only programmed to a yes, thank you. Sorry, I'm messing this up, but anyway.
No, it's
keep going because I love this so much.
Yes, we already have. Yeah.
I started by making a very simple calculation, multiplying 365 days multiplied by 16 hours, and that works out as around 365,400 magnificent gilt edge minutes. And I'll work it all out for you in seconds if you like. No more crazy gobbled dinners with one eye on my food and the other on the clock. This year it's going to be good morning toast. I now propose to cover you very gently with apple jelly, and I'm going to really enjoy every chew. Yeah. This year I'm going to make a list of all the things that I haven't done for a long time. I haven't gone out to Bushy Park and climbed a tree and wait till I watch a cockerel watching a cock-a-doodle-doo. I wonder if they actually ever do that, or do they only ever do it when people aren't looking, so I'm going to cover my eyes and pretend. And there's so much more. Read it. A present to myself.
Oh, Pat. Okay.
Thank
you, Joe. We've got 22 people on the open mic tonight. It's been an absolutely fantastic night. Just before I call up our final poet for the night, because we're about to get all defenestrated very shortly when comes upstairs. We are moving on from here to Megan's around the corner. Probably have some finger food and chats there for a while, so you're all very welcome to join us. We'll have to see you over there. And thank you so much for coming, and keep coming back to Avail, and we hopefully see you for our 13th
episode. You're going to be a teenager.
Yeah.
You're getting puberty.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. Look out. Yeah. Rabbercut.
This is from last year's Five Word Challenge by Margaret McCarthy.
Oh.
And the words are sex, exuberant tempo, marmalade, and aurora. It's called Among Starlings. Aurora tilts a bowl of ambrosia, warm gold fills the morning sky, and there appears a murmuration, an exuberant celebration, as starlings fill the air. In a tempo of their own design, they become a beating heart as they swirl and sweep and somehow keep perfect and united time. Without meaning beyond beauty, they fly close as though conferring, then separate and almost disappear. Each new form shape is clear, yet tantalizing and transient. All belong at age, sex, or shape, or any difference at all, is absorbed and assimilated, accepted and so negated. They become pure energy. All who watch feel it happen, as under the marmalade sky, without touch or speech, beyond earthly reach, souls commingle among stars.
That's gorgeous.
Thank you, Rob, and thank you all for coming tonight. And can we have one more round of applause for our guest poet and winner of the Chant League? Thank you.